This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Our voice, preserving our stories. Join Caroline Vogels and Jess Moorhee for an insight into the lives of our community elders. Joy 94.9 gratefully acknowledges the support of the Victorian Government and Public Record Office Victoria for making this project possible.
Jean Taylor is well known to many lesbians living in Victoria, as Jean is a radical lesbian feminist activist and has been for decades. For those who may not know, Jean, born in 1944, was raised in Mildura and was the eldest of three children. Jean left school at 16 to train as a nurse and by the age of 22 was married, had a son aged 4 and a daughter aged 3, and Jean's second daughter, who was born in 1966, tragically died only 3 days old. By 1969, Jean had finished a manuscript, No Time for Tears, and had started studying English expression and English literature at CAE. And it was through sheer grittiness and determination that Jean matriculated, including in a subject she found very difficult, which was French. Jean came from a hard-working family. However, with two young children, money was always tight. So to fund further studies, Jean worked many nights waitressing, at an assortment of jobs during the school holidays, and juggled being a wife, a mother, and her university life. During this time, Jean had been well aware of the activities of the women's liberation movement, but had thought at times they were a bit radical, maybe a bit out there. And it was not until 1972 that Jean joined the Brunswick Consciousness Raising Group. Less than a year later, Jean had amicably separated from her husband of 11 years and fell in love with her best female friend, Alex. The Brunswick women supported Jean through this emotional time, and in 1979, Jean came out as a lesbian. In addition to being a prolific author, Jean has also worked as a woman's refuge worker, a train driver, a circus performer, where at the age of 47 Jean learnt to walk on stilts, and a director, and is now a lesbian grandmother. So my co-host, Jess Moorhee, and I warmly welcome Jean Taylor to Our Voice.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Now, Jean, did we get all that right? Is there anything that, for the record, we need to correct?
No, that sounds like a good recap of the early years there.
Oh, fantastic. So I guess some of the terminology, we might start with that. It's quite significant when we use terms like lesbian, feminist, activist, radical. What do some of those terms mean for those uninitiated?
Well, I like to call myself a radical lesbian feminist, because it encapsulates all of the activist work that I do in terms of, yes, I'm out as a lesbian and have been for a long time, and I like to work dark as well. I'm also a feminist. I've been a feminist, an active feminist, since, as you were saying, I joined the Consciousness Raising Group in Brunswick in 1972. And the term radical gives it that out there edge, a more political edge, I think, because a lot of people call themselves feminists these days. There's a whole many, many shades of meaning to the word feminist, as there is to the word lesbian. And a lot of lesbians don't even like the word these days, much to my surprise, you know, because for many years that was the term that we were proud to wear, lesbian and dyke, because in the 60s, a lot of lesbians call themselves gay women. You know, that was a term that was very a softer term that a lot of lesbians like to use, and some still do, of course. So to use those three terms, radical, lesbian and feminist, encapsulated my personal as well as all my politics as well.
So during that time, you started out as a very early mother. It was early in the 60s. Would you like to take us through those early days of motherhood, I guess?
Yes. Well, I think looking back, I think becoming pregnant at 17, as a single woman, I was at the time, was probably one of the defining acts of my life. Because once you become pregnant at 17, and also I was fortunate in as much as there wasn't any question that I would be giving up my baby for adoption, as happened with a lot of women in those years, actually. There was a coercion, a social coercion, and a lot of pressure if you were single and pregnant that you would give your baby up. So I was fortunate, in inverted commas really, that the bloke who was the father, I married him. So that meant that socially I was immediately accepted, you know, as a married woman, and my pregnancy was no longer seen as a, you know, something to be frowned upon,
yep.
Even though I was pregnant at 17. It did mean, though, that I had to give up my work at the time. I was training to be a nurse automatically. If I knew that becoming pregnant and then getting married, it was automatic. This was in 1962, can you believe, that women were not allowed to work anymore, you know, in that job. Mm. So I did that. That was one of my escapes, really, I think. So it was sort of frying pan into the fire, yep. In a sense. But it also was an opportunity for me to move to Melbourne. I was brought up in Mildura, small country town, very conservative, you know. And I remember coming down from Mildura on the train. I had hardly any money. My new husband of 2 days didn't have a job. I was 2 months pregnant.
Oh, wow.
And we landed in Flinders Street, Spencer Street Station, as yep. It was, came out onto Spencer Street, and the sun was rising over Bourke Street. It was all very romantic. Sun was rising over Bourke Street. And I thought, this is it. The whole world was at my feet.
Oh,
you know, it was wonderful.
Yeah.
I was born in Melbourne, and even though I left Melbourne when I was quite young, I always had this whole love of Melbourne. You know, we used to come for holidays. And so to be in the city that I loved with the bloke that I loved at the time, pregnant, I was 18, 3 weeks after my 18th birthday, and it was like, this is it, my life has started. It was fantastic.
Did you have the support of your parents?
Yes, I did. My mother, I was terrified about telling my mother. I was the oldest good daughter. I had always behaved myself. She had no idea that I'd started sexual relationships with blokes when I was 16. You know, it wouldn't tell her anything like that. My mother would not have stood that for a second. So that having to tell her that I was pregnant was admitting that I had been already sexually active. And you know, in those days it was just a no-no. And my mother was a very conservative woman, loving, wonderful woman. I really loved my mother, and we had a good relationship, older daughter thing. And so telling her was pretty drastic. But within about 2 minutes of hearing that I was pregnant, she immediately went into, because I told her I was getting married, which immediately clicked on for her. Oh, that's all right. She's getting married. Abortion wasn't a question, you know, because that was another big no-no.
Yeah.
And so she said, you know, well, we'll have to start, you know, organising the wedding. And she did.
Oh, which is fantastic to have that support.
Mm.
So you've brought a song with us today, with you today, by Judy Small. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Now, Judy Small is somebody whom I've long admired as a singer-songwriter. And on this particular CD, it's a compilation of all her lesbian and gay songs, because for many years while her mother was alive, she had to be a bit closeted around her sexuality in public. You know, she could do it on stage, but not in a you know, public sense where her mother would find out. And so when this CD came out, it was quite a delight. So this particular song is a very amusing song. Judy is a very a witty woman, and amusing and humorous, and I really enjoy her.
We managed to see her at Lesbians in the House, which was a concert that was redone 20 years after the initial concert.
Yes.
And Judy Small was one of the acts 20 years ago, and we saw her last year, and the organisers just did a fantastic job to bring, you know, so many people back together. Mm. And, yeah, she's still got it, I'd have to say.
She certainly has.
Joy 94.9.
Our Voice. Preserving the stories of our community elders. Joy 94.9.
You're on Joy 94.9 with my co-host Jess Moorhee, and we're joined with by Jean Taylor. And Jean, we were just talking about before the song about motherhood and what it means for you, and We did mention in the introduction that you lost your baby after only 3 days. And would you like to talk a little bit about how that was at the time for you and how it still is now?
My baby lived 3 days, as you were saying, and I'd had 2 children by that stage who were 3 and 2 at the time. So I had no idea that things wouldn't just progress as they had previously. I seemed to have been able to get pregnant fairly easily and have the babies fairly easily, and I enjoyed my pregnancies. So the whole problem meant that she died after 3 days started during the birth. So there was nothing in the lead up. I was healthy, all the rest of it. So the placenta came away too early, therefore she started dying already before she was born. And when she was born, she was put into a Humira crib straight away and just was lasted, you know, it was alive for the 3 days. So in those days, this was 1966, there was no support services around all of that. I was devastated. It was the worst thing that's ever happened to me. Even now, if something happens, you know, around on the TV or something around babies dying and stuff, I'll be in tears because of that experience. And so it was very, 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 very drastic and unhappy time at that stage. So I think it's good nowadays that there are support services, that women do get the support. In fact, I never, ever held my child. In those days, you weren't allowed to. That was another shocking thing. Mm. In fact, my arms ached for months and months and months because of that deprivation. So I'm very pleased that that there's a much more humane approach to these things these days, and that even on the TV the other night I saw a baby who was going to be dying out of the Humira crib, and she was allowed to hold her baby till the baby died. Mm. And of course I was in tears because that hadn't been my experience. So I'm very glad that also that I've been part of a movement and a liberation of people that has allowed the social context for women in particular, and in this case for women and their babies, that that we're not as devastated by our experiences as we were in our 60s in the 1960s. Mm. This happened.
Did you have the opportunity to name her?
Yes. Her name Michelle. Mm. Michelle Jean. Mm. And in fact, it's talked about in our family, you know, because she was part of our family. The kids, my children, grew up knowing that they had a sister who died. And in fact, my only granddaughter, her second name is Michelle.
Oh, that's
lovely. When my son asked me that, I was very, very moved that he wanted to name my granddaughter Katerina Michelle after his sister who died.
Yeah, it's really quite beautiful. So that, and you have a close relationship, I believe, with the Grandies.
Yes, I do. they're the other loves of my life, really.
Yeah. Oh, excellent.
Becoming a grandmother at age 52, I was a bit taken aback because my daughter had always said she didn't want to have children, and I didn't expect her to have children. So when she became pregnant, I was a bit startled, and I thought, I'm not ready to be a grandmother yet. I don't even know, because I never had grandparents. All of my grandparents had died before I was born, so I had no experience of being what that involved. And actually called a workshop at the next conference I was at for lesbian grandmothers.
Oh, excellent.
So that I would learn. And I said, look, I'm going to be a lesbian grandmother. I need to know how to be as a lesbian grandmother. And they very kindly told me, and I took notes.
But what a fantastic thing to do, though, is call on your colleagues that you lent on in many times, but for something...
The good thing about being a radical lesbian feminist activist, you have access to conferences and workshops and stuff, and you can make it up as you go along, and very easy to facilitate something like that.
Great idea.
So you're listening to Our Voice with Jess and Caroline. We have author Jean Taylor in the studio with us today. Jean, you've mentioned how you initially were studying to become a nurse. You've taken us on the journey which brought you back to Melbourne, where you were born, and you are a young mother, married, with young children. How did you start on this journey to become such a successful author?
Well, the year after... my daughter died. She died in 1966. In 1967, my other two children, went to kindergarten for the first time. That was very difficult for me because, you know, not they'd always been with me, you know, and having lost a child, I wasn't happy to have them out of my sight, really. But it was, they were getting towards school age, and it was appropriate that they start kindergarten. So for 3 hours a day when they were at kindergarten, they were 3 and 4 at this stage, I had 3 hours to myself for the first time in years. And I'd always wanted to write when I was younger, you know, and I thought I'm going to write a novel. So I did. I started writing a novel, and I found that I couldn't write at home because I'd drop the kids at kinder, go home, and then I'd think, oh, I'll just do the dishes. Mm-hmm. Oh, look at that. That needs to be done. So what I finally did, we lived in South Melbourne at that stage, renting a little place, and I went to the South Melbourne Library. So I dropped the kids off, go to the library, and write, and painfully write 2 pages a day. I had to do that, and it was excruciating. But I found that if I didn't write, it was even more excruciating. Once I'd started, I couldn't stop. But it was still very, very difficult in those days to start and to continue. But I knew if I didn't do that, I'd feel unfulfilled and unhappy. And so that was my little time for myself. The rest of my time was taken up with work and everything else.
So when you say it was difficult, can you explain that? Was it difficult from outsiders or from yourself, from within?
From myself.
Yeah.
I didn't tell anybody.
Right.
I was a closeted writer.
Okay.
There wasn't any way I was going to go around announcing that I was a writer, because I imagine people just would go into fits of laughter and go, oh, my God, Jean, who do you think you are? You know, that sort of thing. In Australia in those days, it was very difficult. We're talking in the 60s, a woman, you know, presuming a mother, you know, with children, to presume to want to write. Well, that would have just been beyond the pale completely.
Yeah.
So apart from my immediate family, nobody else knew I was writing.
So what did you write about? What was this novel about?
It was about four, it's hard to remember now, but four people, four young women. From different perspectives and what happened to them. And one came down from the country, not surprisingly, and met up with these other three in the city. And just it was about relationships with their mothers and what happened to them in their relationships with the men in their lives.
So it's quite a big transition then to writing a tome with about 770 pages called Brazen Hussies, History of Radical Activism in the Women's Liberation Movement in Victoria. Tell us about that transition to go from a small novel to a huge work. And I'd have to say it's an incredible book where you wind the stories of fact of all the organisations and many colourful people that were involved in them, but also you relate to the Koori women. And then into all that, you also wind your own story, which I personally find why the book's quite readable and it's so enjoyable, because to me a history book of dry facts generally sits and collects dusts, but I think you've done an incredible job on just winding it. It's a very personal journey, and you also highlight how you weren't born an activist. You were quite liberal in some of your views early on, so it's a huge transition. So tell us about how it all evolved.
Well, thank you for your kind comments about the book. It's good to get a bit of feedback about it. Well, once I'd started writing, of course, I wanted to continue. So in my early writings through the 70s and 80s, I was mainly writing fiction. So everything I wrote about from my own life or lives of, you know, people around me, I would write into story form. So that continued for quite some time. But then later on, when I realised that I wanted to write a book about the women's liberation movement, it necessarily had to be in a non-fiction style. So, and by that time, I was getting older, and I started to like non-fiction a bit better. I like biographies and that kind of thing. And it was the combination of. I also joined the Victorian Women's Liberation Lesbian Feminist Archives, as it's called now. And in 84, and my activist work and my writing. So the three combined, the three passions, if you like, you know, because I was involved in the 70s and in the 80s, and still feel, you know, I'm an activist. So it was the combination of those three passions, the writing, the archive work that I was doing and the activist work, the involvement as well, it seemed imperative that I write a book about the Women's Liberation Movement. And I tried different ways of writing it. And it seemed, I'm a bit of a, you know, facts kind of a person. You know, this started this day, this was the first issue here, this is what was in it, you know, and this is how it's progressed. And so it wasn't until about the fourth or fifth or tenth rewrite of the book that I actually put my own personal story in and pulled it together. Because that seemed to be the linking thing and that there needed to be. Because I'd interviewed a lot of activists and put their stories in, and I thought it was only fair if I was putting their stories in, and some were very, very open about, domestic violence and that kind of stuff, that I necessarily had to add my own story as well, to give that balance.
And I'd imagine you'd need some sort of substantial details and experience in your own life to be able to add something beneficial to the story. Yeah. So what was happening in your own personal life during that time that you felt you needed to add?
Well, there was a huge transition for me in the 70s. I started at the beginning of the 70s as a mother of two, a married mother of two, and I was a radical lesbian feminist by the end of it. So I wanted to get that transition in. It took me a long while to do that, mind you. But also, over the years, I've kept a diary, and from the 1980s, I kept a journal. So once I came out as a lesbian, I was having to sort of sort through a lot of my own feelings around that. And I had assumed I could just become a lesbian, that's it, but I had to learn to be a lesbian. It takes a long while to learn how to be as a lesbian in the world when you've been taught to be straight. So I've had to rely on my own personal journals and my diaries, which is very fortunate because who knows? How would I know what I did in the 70s unless I had something to base it on? And plus all the primary the sources of publications and stuff that we've got in the archives is an invaluable, absolutely invaluable. And ALGA's the same, the Australian Gay and Lesbian and Gay Archives and our archives. Have all of the primary publications from the 70s, 80s and 90s. And so I've had to rely on all of those sort of things. Plus, I just felt our lives, not only my life, our lives were exciting. What we were doing was exciting. It was like an explosion in our heads, you know. Suddenly we realised that all the oppression and the conditioning that we'd had all those years was nonsense. And that we could live our lives completely differently, and we did. And we, whatever we wanted to do, we just went, oh, well, this is what I want to do, I'll just do it.
And it's certainly something that transcends in the book, is the excitement of all those heady days and women just, you know, if I can say normal women or everyday women, like locking themselves and chaining themselves to the government buildings. And that's what I think comes through in the book, is just, you know, they're not people that are sort of on a stage somewhere that you think they don't have any fallout from all this. They have then got to go back to their daily life of whatever that may be. And I just think they're so brave. But I think that's one of the beautiful things that has also come through is this, these everyday women doing extraordinary things. You're listening to Jean Taylor, the author of Brazen Hussies, as well as many other books and poems and literature. You're joining with my co-host Jess Morhy, and this is Joy 94.9 on Our Voice.
You're on Joy 94.9 listening to Our Voice with Jess and Caroline, and our special guest today is author, lesbian feminist activist Jean Taylor. Jean, you've brought in a song with you today, In My Kitchen. Tell us why you chose this song.
Now, I was a big fan of Titus for a long time, but I actually met Lou Bennett prior to her becoming a member of the group Titus, and I have long admired Lou's work, and I was actually there at the end of when they broke up as well, and crying in the audience as they were doing, I think it was their second last concert at Trades Hall. So, and In My Kitchen is a very poignant song, and Lou actually launched one of my books called The C Word way back in 99, and she sang this song at the launch, and it's one of my favourite songs.
You're on Joy 94.9. You're listening to Our Voice with Jean Taylor and my co-host Jess Moore here, and my name's Caroline. And we just heard the beautiful sounds of Titus inside my kitchen. And it might be an opportunity, Jean, to talk about some of the issues that you raise in Brazen Hussies about Indigenous people being, Indigenous women being separatist in some ways and the reasons for that. Mm. And also Lou Bennett is trying to bring different things together in the organisations. And so if you could, tell the listener a little bit about the background.
Mm. Well, I don't think you can be an activist and somebody who's politically aware in this country without also acknowledging that the Indigenous people of Australia have had a very, very raw deal since the invasion. So in the 70s, once I started becoming a radical feminist and an activist, I wanted to become involved in supporting Aboriginal concerns. But it was very difficult. And I do make mention in the book that there wasn't one single group through the 70s out of the Women's Liberation Movement where we started dealing with our own racism or looking at what was happening in the country in terms of the Indigenous people, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, and what we might do about it. And it wasn't until the 1980s that a group started up in Melbourne called the Aboriginal Rights Solidarity Group. I was a founding member of that, where I and others, non-Aboriginal people, had the opportunity at the direction of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities here in Melbourne to be supportive, and we did fundraising and did a newsletter and a whole lot of other things, and I describe all that about that in Stroppy Dykes. So it was a huge relief to me to be able to begin looking at my own racism, and they were very clear that we had to deal with our own racism and look at how we acted in the world and what we did, and not do anything unless they asked us to do it. And the two major things were to raise money, because we're leading up into the anti-bicentennial actions that were happening in 1988, and also to inform non-Aboriginal people about what had actually happened in this country. So it's interesting now to realise that back even as near as the 80s, there was very little information, that all of us were profoundly ignorant about what had actually gone on. And those of us who'd been trying to find out had limited books. Nowadays there's a lot of books, there's a lot of information. And I think that's another one of the big things over the last 40 years, that the Aboriginal people have been determined to make sure that we understood what was actually going on, us non-Aboriginal people, that we would pressure our governments to stop having racist policies and that kind of thing, and that in our own lives that we would stop having racist attitudes and be ignorant about and prejudiced about what had actually happened and what is still happening, you know, in this country. I've just come up back from a trip up north, and we happened to be in Broome for NAIDOC Week, the National Aboriginal Islander Day commemoration and celebration week, and they had a lot of activities up there. We were pleased to be part of. So down here, we would go to events down here for NAIDOC Week, go on the march, and I've been going on the march for many, many years. And it was pleasing to see Broome. They were celebrating their 25th NAIDOC celebrations, and they had a lot of activities. So I was able to go on the march, because I often, if I'm out of Melbourne in July, I don't like missing out on the things. So I was able to do it in Broome, which was fantastic.
It sounds like the length that you had to go to, the research involved, and then the policies and procedures you needed to adhere to even write these books was quite tough at times. When it came to actually publishing the books, was that an easy experience?
No. Now, that's the other part of... I started self-publishing my own books in 1976 because I'd been trying for years. The first novel I'd sent off. So it wasn't... Nobody picked it up. So then I started writing a second novel and probably the third novel. There was still nothing happening. So in 1976, I was at La Trobe, and one of my extracurricular activities was being on Rabelais, the student newspaper, so I'd help with layout and all that, and all those things where you had to cut and paste physically by hand. And also I was on the poetry collective, And I realised that I could do this. It wasn't rocket science. And so I decided to start self-publishing my own books. So I started with a small poetry book and worked my way up. And so when it came to, and I stopped self-publishing about 10 or so years ago. It's expensive. It was out of my own pocket. You don't get everything back, of course. And so when it came to these books, I thought, no, I'm going to try again. You know, these are important books, which I felt were important books, but nobody picked them up, of course. After a couple of years, I thought, I'll just have to bite the bullet and set up the Dyke Books Inc. and put them out myself. So this is with my own money and, a small collective of lesbians, and we put the books out.
It's a great name.
Yeah, it is a great name, but it is also amazing. Like a book, it might take you 10 years to write, and then yes. You also have to form your own publishing company and basically, distribute it. So it really is
right.
From every step of the way.
Yes.
It's been a fight. And, we do acknowledge the amount of work that you've done there. It's just incredible.
But it's the passion has kept me going. It's the passion for life and for what we do that keeps us going.
Yep.
It keeps joy going. It keeps all of the things that we do as unpaid members of our community to make sure that we, are on the airwaves, that we've got books to read and magazines to pick up and that sort of stuff. And if we didn't have that passion, we wouldn't do it. We wouldn't be here in the studio at 9 o'clock in the morning, that kind of thing. Or, it's a very important aspect of being an activist and radical lesbian feminist or whatever, name we want to call ourselves.
So you mentioned Stroppy Dykes, and I managed to have a little copy here, and I'll tell you to the listener, it's quite a weighty tome.
Not a little copy.
It's
a large book.
Yeah, it's 872 pages. And if I may, I'd just like to read out the first paragraph in January 1980. And Jean goes on to say, "In 3 months, ever since Bridie and I had become lovers and I'd come out as a lesbian during the September school holidays last year, my life had changed and changed utterly. My relationship with John had come to an abrupt end, although we continued to be friends. I'd resigned from my job as coordinator at Matilda Women's Refuge and had made the decision to leave Jeff in my house in Brunswick and move with Christy to live in Gippsland with Bridie and her two daughters. Now, I think that that's an opening paragraph to something that could be filmed. Like it's, in that one paragraph you encapsulate so many life-changing events and...
Well, I think that's one of the other defining experiences of my life, finally coming out as a lesbian. And your life does change. All my friends changed, my life changed, I moved, And I think because I came out a bit later in life, I was 35, I was ready. I was more than ready and wanting to embrace that life. And also my creativity broadened. I think once you find your true self and who you really are and what you want to be, life falls into place, doesn't it? It becomes broader. It becomes more joyous. You've got more energy, enthusiasm, and that, of course, was one of the major things for me.
Our voice, preserving our stories. Join Caroline Vogels and Jess Moorhy for an insight into the lives of our community elders.
You're on Joy 94.9 listening to Our Voice with Caroline and Jess. And joining us today is author Jean Taylor. Jean, we asked you to, if you could bring in a piece of memorabilia with you today. Could you describe what that beautiful thing is you're holding right there?
Now, this is a small ceramic piece that was made by Magira, who's an artist, and it's a little Sheila Nagig, which is a small representation of a famous Irish female who is being very explicitly showing her genitals and bare-breasted and smiling. And what I really like about it, and I'm presuming why Magira specifically chose to do a ceramic, and it's on a thong that can be worn around the neck. I don't usually wear anything around my neck. I have it hanging up at home. It's a very joyous, confronting image, challenging image of a woman being very proud of her sexuality, her female sexuality. And given that we don't have these kinds of representations in this joyous, non pornographic, if you like, way. It's a very, it's not a pornographic image at all. It's a very joyously affirming image of a female. So that's why I like it. And also because Megera very kindly offered one of her paintings to grace the cover of Stroppy Dykes, called We Fight for All We Hold Dear, which is of an image of another naked woman who's holding up a labrys over her shoulder, ready to do battle if necessary.
Extremely attractive woman, I must say. Yes. And such a great cover.
It is a great cover, and I think it does manage to portray someone that's, confident and, powerful in a way, I guess, but, bare-breasted and quite muscular and just all the things that we don't generally equate to seeing a woman on the front of the cover of a book, actually. It's, fantastic. And, that would be great in a mural of, the half the size of the wall
to adorn all our
bedrooms. I think it's really quite lovely.
Yeah, very powerful.
Yeah, full of strength and very Amazonian in a sense, women who are... Who knows who she is.
Yep.
She looks like she knows who she is, and she's prepared to defend that right to be who she is.
Yep.
Well, as always, we will take a couple of photos of those items and put them up on our social media page. If you are wanting to get in contact with us at all, you can send us an email. Please head along to the Joy website, which is joy.org.au. You can find our voice page there and send in emails, any feedback you may have. And you can also connect to us via social media and see these fantastic photos.
Sounds really good. So the... You've done so many things that we won't have time to mention today. Some of them, you've travelled overseas, you've lived overseas, you've lived in Paris for a while, you've written there. What are your goals and dreams for, today? Obviously, you've got a full family life, but, take us through Jean Taylor 2012.
Well, of course, my major thing is still my writing. I've taken a year off from writing these trilogies at the moment, but I'm writing other things. I'm trying to do a little bit of memoirs and family, her story, for my family, really, as well as articles and stuff like that I'm doing as, to keep writing, and some published, some not, So, but next year, I'm very keen, and I always already feel this next book, every now and then I think of things that I'm going to put in it. So that'll probably take me another couple of years to write. So I'm very keen to keep that in mind, and I'm going to start interviewing activists and lesbians too in preparation for this book. I'm going to start this in the second half of this year. But also my activist life is still very... very present. I'm still a collective member of several lesbian collectives, including still the Victorian Women's Liberation Lesbian Feminist Archives. My grandchildren are still a very big part of my life. I look after them every Thursday afternoon, to give their parents a bit of a break. They both work, and alternate their times off as well. They both work part-time. And also I'm just about to go off to Tassie to visit my oldest grandchild, who's turning 16 this year.
Oh, wow.
Which is unbelievable. But then,
pretty exciting.
So, and Artie, of course, Artie and I have a full loving life. We've just come back from our trip up north, which has been very good, very beneficial. And I think that's important too. That's why I like travelling, not only because it's... you're seeing other places and stuff, but it's necessary, I think, in Australia as well. I've travelled a lot overseas, but also within Australia a great deal, that we connect with the outback, that Australia has vast inland deserts, outback, beautiful coastal waters, warm coastal waters. My goodness, we didn't even see a spot of rain and no clouds for the 5 weeks we're away. No rain till we got to Perth, on the way home. So... we need to be reminded that Australia is vast and that the world is vast, and we need to reconnect with that. And I like travelling quite a bit. So I do it as cheaply as possible. My life's always been a bit reduced down financially and stuff, so that I can live as I want to live. And I still have a passion for life,
yes,
I have to say.
That's quite evident.
Can I just ask, before we go to some messages. Do you find that if we go back to the activism role and using that word dykes, when I was young and coming out, I saw the dykes in my community as the strong, powerful women that really took me under their wing and showed me the ways of how to be me. And I knew I could always go to them for protection and they would be there and they were pioneers in our community. Do you find that that still is strong with the younger generations that are coming up with my generation, or is it something that's being passed on? Because I still have it in my image, in my imagination, as the elders of our community doing the work for us. Me being in my 30s, what can my role be in to continue this legacy that, that you've forged for us?
Well, I think there's a great gap in one sense between those of us who are in the 70s and those young dykes who are just coming up. So you're sort of in the middle of some continuum. And I think the lesbians immediately after us, I think where they were still taking notice of us, but it's like that that's what they did over there in those days, but now we're going to do something differently. And certainly from the early 90s onwards, the rise of the queer communities, you know, I was quite shocked, you know, as I said before, when lesbians were saying we don't want to use the word lesbian, you know, having taken that as an identity, and then to be told by the next generation, well, that's all passé now. And that's still quite true. I think there's still a lot of a bit of mentoring, and there are a lot of lesbians, old lesbians of my age and my generation, who are very keen to make connections with the young lesbians, and especially over the internet. See, we did, ours was very face-to-face and personal, all of our interaction. We had collectives where you sat in a room and you saw each other, whereas nowadays it's mainly, it seems to me, on internet and things like that, which is a social media is fantastic. You can have instantaneous connections in that sense. So that I think it can be somewhat problematic sometimes, given there's a different style or a different way of looking at the world. And certainly your age, you've inherited a world that's quite different to the world I was coming into as a lesbian, even in the, you know, late 70s, early 80s. So I think we do need to maintain contact. I think we do need to talk to each other. But one of the impetuses for writing these books is that there's a general ignorance about what happened. You know, how many lesbians of a 20-year-old lesbian who would know that the very first activist group in Australia around lesbian and gay issues was the lesbian group in 69. And those pioneering lesbians, that was the first in Australia, the first active. The others were all social groups, you know, checkmates and stuff. And they decided to go on television. And that was, they were initially called the Daughters of Bilitis after the group in the US, and became the Australasian, you can imagine, lesbian movement. Well, this is in the middle 70s. So, I mean, those sorts of things. I had to find that out. Nobody told me. I had to do it. When I found all that out, I was absolutely blown away. And I met two of the women who started that group. I mean, goodness me, they were still alive, you know. Yeah. And so I think there's not enough known. And this is why I'm very keen for young lesbians to know her story, to know that there's been a lot of work done, a lot of hours put into making it possible to walk down the street and hold hands, and that you can be out and proud and that kind of thing. And I think it's and there needs to be a lot of more dialogue and much more chatting and over the internet. I'm happy with that too, that we can keep talking with each other.
And even for women more broadly, when you think the work that was done on abortion reform, but to think that in 2008, finally that law was passed to make it legal. However, without all that work that had went before, so it's even can affect a lot more than, you know, I'm not saying just lesbians, but you know, it's a really broad women's amount of issue. Work that you know, these activists have done, or else there's no way it would have even got to that stage.
No, so. And also that there still needs to be vigilance, because that can be taken back
that's
at any
right.
time.
And
you know, so
as we see in Queensland, what the rollback is, we're going back to the Joe Bielke-Peterson days, and it's frightening.
I know. And so simply and quickly that can happen, and people have to be vigilant. And I think there's an opportunity for young people too, because sometimes, see, I want to concentrate on the books more now. So if there's activist work to be done, there's a lot of activist work that still needs doing. And it must necessarily be done by younger, you know, the younger lesbians these days, or the young queer women who will take on that kind of pressuring to... yes, in Queensland. I don't know what they're doing up there, but they have to do something up there.
Well, I, for one, am very grateful for all of your hard work. We're going to go to some messages and come back with more from Jean Taylor on Joy 94.9. You're listening to Our Voice on Joy 94.9. Today's guest is Jean Taylor, a woman of extraordinary talents and quite an incredible life, with, I'm sure, many more fascinating stories to come. If you could be anywhere in the world, where would you like to be right now?
Well, my favourite place in the world, apart from Melbourne, I really love Melbourne. This is where I want to live and die, really, in Melbourne, is Paris.
So if you could distill your life into one experience, and that was the best experience of your life, what would have that been? Or what?
I think there's lots of things that we have that we enjoy in life. But I think the two most pivotal things that I still see as my benchmark for absolute joy was birthing my two children, because they not only was I mentally and physically in every way involved in that, there is a miracle every time a child is born. It's a minor miracle. It's incredible. Suddenly you one, and then suddenly there's this baby.
Well, thank you, Jean Taylor. You've been an incredible guest on Our Voice. We've been talking about just a very small part of the part you have played in, where we are today. We've talked briefly about books, Brazen Hussies and Stroppy Dykes. There is literally so much more to talk about. I wanted to talk about the Amazon lands in northern New South Wales. I wanted to talk about the book The C Word and the death of your partner, Maureen. And obviously you will need to come back. But for tonight, we'd like to say thank you very much for joining Jess Moyer and myself on Our Voice.
And thank you to you, Carolyn, and to you, Jess. And it's a wonderful interview. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Our Voice on Joy 94.9. For more information, head to joy.org.au to connect with Our Voice online.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.